You're listening to the Anomalous Podcast Network. Multiple voices, one phenomenon.
Hey everybody, how's it going? Welcome back to the channel. And for the first time in a while, we're not talking about Calvin. Thank goodness. I joke, but yeah, one thing I will say about that is the investigation is ongoing for all the many messages that I'm getting. That's ongoing. But what we're doing tonight is we're focusing on some historic cases because I've spent the last few days digging back into some National Archives records and looking at some really interesting cases with multiple data points, and they are fascinating. So we're going to cover some cases tonight with my guest, and we're probably going to start doing this on a regular basis, you know, looking back at cases that need to be probably brought forward a little bit more, because they really are, they're just as good as any modern case, if not better in some respects. So yeah, good to see you guys in the live chat. Thank you for being here. Keep it nice, calm and cordial. And yeah, that'd be great. We'll have a smooth show. So yeah, let's not waste any more time. Let's bring in my guest, my colleague at UAP Media UK, my good friend and an amazing author, Mr. Graham Rendell. Graham, how's it going?
Hello, Vinny. Here's to you, mate.
Oh,
I've got a nice Argentinian Malbec here.
I had a couple of glasses of red with my dinner, but oh well, cool. You're making me envious there. Well, listen, thank you so much for doing this, Graham. And as I just said, you know, I've been diving back into some archives, some documents, which is something that I did for many years before I even did any of my social medias or even came on the scene. I was always in the background, late at night, in front of this screen, digging. And I've kind of just rekindled that love for it again. And we mentioned before we came on about going to the National Archives as well. And that was the first time last year when we both went together. And I can see how addicting it is, how that feel for like finding that little gem mixed in those documents that's been, you know, archived away for so many years. So yeah, how long have you been going to the archives and things like that? And do you still get the buzz every time you go?
So digging into the archives, actually physically going to queue, that was my first time. I've done a lot of stuff remotely because of COVID, you couldn't go anyway. So for 2 years, kind of thing that I was doing things, I was having to pay, do everything the long way. So pay them to search. And then if they found anything, then I would have to pay again for the records to be either sent digitally or in a post. And sometimes you lost money because the things you were asking for, they couldn't find, and you had to stump up like £8 for a search fee. But there's also things like Freedom of Information Act requests that, you know, you can do as well online. So a few of them in the past. And then again, it's just trawling through online archives like Hansard, the government archive, you know, of all the transcripts of all the debates in the House of Lords, the House of Commons in the UK, and some of the written replies to questions. You can look through those on the internet, and you can delve into things that way, and you can see, you know, debates on UFOs going back into the 70s and even earlier. So there's a lot of stuff like that. But of course, in a previous life, and it's sort of continued into now, that I write about aviation history as well. So a lot of the things I used to do have basically translated themselves really easily to UFOs. It's the same kind of thing. I'm looking at the historical documents. I did that for the aviation history. So again, I'm looking at you know, loss records for people. When you're looking at sometimes casualties, that's obviously, I'm not looking at those for UFOs, but those types of online record databases, there's a lot of things like that you can search. And you're just pulling out little bits of information, you're setting them against something else that you might have found out, and you're seeing whether they match or whether there's any discrepancies, and then you chase down what the discrepancies are. And you just keep, you just, you know, the sky's the limit kind of thing in terms of how much information you might be able to amass. But then again, it's then a question of distilling it down into a form that's easy enough to read and understand. You can't assume that everybody who reads it is up to speed with UFOs. Some people might just pull it off, you know, the bookshelf or buy it on Amazon, and they know nothing about the subject and they want to, to get into it much easier. So you have to sort of pitch it to a lot of different audiences.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing that I really found rewarding was going back all those years where I was doing a lot of research. I was researching a lot of the American files, so the Blue Book files and things like that. But then when I started digging into the UK National Archives, you'd come across cases that you'd seen in Blue Book, but from the UK perspective. And when you match them up together, that is amazing because you've got both sides and double the details, the evidence and stuff. So I found that really rewarding. And one thing that I initially kind of was a bit wary of was when you, before our visit to the National Archives, it asks you what files you want. And you're like, well, I just want to look at this and this, but you need to give them specific numbers. Now
you've got to do a lot of homework beforehand, Vinny.
Yeah.
You know, as the audience may or may not appreciate, it's not a case of, as you say, just going down to them and talking to the guy on the desk and saying, oh, I need to see your files on UFOs for, you know, X month, X year. It doesn't work that way. You have to find the file references and you have to tell them in advance online, and then they'll find them and they'll put them in a little kind of little pigeonhole for you when you turn up. And you can only take one file at a time to the reading desks to go through them, as well, I found out certainly because I got told off by a member of staff for having like 8 or 9 stacked up on the desk.
I actually had the stack as well about that high, but I was right in the far corner of the archives and no one saw me, so I got away with it. So for anybody that does want to dig into this, my recommendation would be reach out to people that have already done it, and people really do want to help, and that helped me. So, you know, it's, and this is the thing, like, I've struggled in the past going, where do I start? And I think you have to first think about the era. You know, is it the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and then whittle it down from there. But what would you suggest to anybody, Graham, about, you know, I just want to look at cool UFO documents. Where would you start?
So there's plenty out there already. If you search for likes of, you know, NICAP, there's kind of or other sort of online databases, there is lots of documentation out there. NICAP have a good sort of stock of old documents for covering all sorts of types of cases, and you can look at them online. Also, there is an internet archive which has all the Blue Book documents, or at least all the ones that can be found, and that's available online as well. I'm sure it's called the Internet Archive, and it's, you can just specify a month and a year, and then it pulls them all out. Now, obviously, it's mostly American-centric, so for people outside America, if they're looking for something nearer to home, then it may not quite cover what they're looking for. But it does have foreign cases in it. It does have some British cases. It does have some from South America, from Africa, and elsewhere. And a lot, actually, it does have a lot from Japan, which I think we're going to talk about one in a minute, in a few minutes, and places like Korea as well. So there's definitely, you know, a good spread of cases geographically. But then The Ministry of Defence released a whole load of UK documents, and they're through the National Archives, so you can actually see them. And there's plenty of places on the internet which actually give the file names, so it's not as if you're having to to search yourself. But you can do that. There is a search engine on the National Archives website which you can just literally put UFO into, and it comes up with all the relevant links. And a lot of that, if you create an account with the National Archives, then you can download. It's either 30 or 100 documents for free each month. 100 documents each month for free, which is quite a lot. And it rolls over each month. So that's a good way to get a lot of those. And some of them are quite considerable in size. They run to hundreds of pages. A lot of it's, dare I say it, dross. It's a lot, you've probably seen these, that some of them are taken up with people writing weird and wacky, you know, letters to the MOD with screes and screes of religious text and things that they believe, or their kind of scripture, or their, you know, or all these weird and wonderful kind of things that they're spouting. And very little of it actually makes any sense and can be backed up with any kind of evidence at all. But, you know, some people might think it's fun reading it, but there's a lot of good stuff in there as well.
Absolutely. One thing I noticed going through the files was that you'd have that kind of dross, as you call it, but you go from one page of dross and the next page could be an internal memo between MOD and DI-55 or something, and you're like, wow, there's some really interesting
and it's
information.
It's not sorted out into any kind of genre in terms of, you know, the wacky stuff. And as you say, you know, the real kind of gems. It almost seems to be some kind of date order, and it's in rough date order. So you can see sometimes, I'm not going to mention Calvin, but you can mention other cases. You can see sometimes you'll find a document about a certain case, and then because the investigation might have taken a few weeks, then there'll be another document, you know, a bit later on in the file, and then there'll be another follow-up a bit later on because they might have come back to it somehow, or there might be a reply by the original correspondent who notified the MOD of the case or reported it. And they're going, you know, he or she coming back saying, I don't agree with what you've said. And then there's another reply to that, and an official reply, which might have some more information in it. So you get this kind of toing and froing, but it's split out between the files. So I'm afraid you have to be patient. You can't expect miracles. You're not going to necessarily, well, you're not really going to get many answers, if any, from the MOD documents. But you just have to dig, and you just have to put it together with other things that you found out or things from elsewhere. And it slowly builds up a picture.
It does. And that's probably one of the reasons why I wanted to do this and to continue doing this, is that you find multiple data points for individual cases. So, you know, we talk about modern cases like the Nimitz encounter, for example, how there's, you know, testimony, there's radar, apparently. Well, a lot of these cases dating right back have got that as well. You just have to be patient, find it, and then put it all together. But
there's other things as well. You can look at the names of the people involved, and you can search old newspapers, and you might get more information that way from a case which doesn't necessarily make it into the official investigation, such as Blue Book. And then you can chase down those people. And then occasionally, very, very occasionally, you'll find that they actually write accounts of these sightings themselves for sometimes little known UFO newsletters in the 50s, 60s and 70s. And that's another good way of finding just a little bit, you know, more information about certain cases, which just adds up, you know, just to build a bigger picture. And obviously these are people's personal recollections, so they're not necessarily 100% accurate, but that picture just expands more than just a few brief words in an intelligence document.
Mm. Absolutely. So let's move on to this first case that I wanted to discuss. And I think this one is from Dawn of the Flying Saucers. Am I right?
Yeah, it is.
So let's bring up my screen. So this is the 1946 to 1949 Aerial UFO Encounters and Official Investigations, written by yourself, foreword by George Knapp. That's amazing, isn't it?
Really happy with that.
Yeah. Right. So I'm just going to go to the first image. So here we go then.
So the picture is a Northrop P-61 Black Widow. Now, those of you, and I see you're wearing the T-shirt of the cover there, of the Foo Fighters book that I wrote last year, these aircraft featured quite heavily in that, because a couple of the squadrons that were seeing them in Belgium and also in Italy were flying this particular type of aircraft. It's actually a night fighter, and it was the first aircraft that the Americans built for their Army Air Force. It was a specific night fighter. So you had either a crew of two or a crew of three. So there was a pilot, there was a radar observer who obviously operated the airborne radar system, and sometimes they had a gunner on board. This aircraft here doesn't have one, but they occasionally had a remote-controlled gun turret on top. You can see a kind of little circle on top of their aircraft, and that's where it would have been fitted. So there could have been sometimes a third member of crew on some of these types of aircraft. I'm just going to refer to a couple of notes because I want to actually read out part of the intelligence document with this particular case. I'll sort of set the scene as well. So we're looking at the 15th of October 1948, and this is off the coast of Japan. And this is before the Korean War. So you're looking at about a year and a half before that kicked off. It's during the American occupation of Japan after the Second World War, and they've got air bases there where they're flying aircraft. And they're flying, you know, sort of patrols over the Yellow Sea and places around Japan, because obviously there's a possible threat to get from the Chinese, the communists, but also from the Russians as well. So it's not a flashpoint as such quite then, but it's a place where obviously the Americans are heavily invested. And this happens a fortnight after the so-called Gorman dogfight, I've talked about at length elsewhere, which was this happened to a P-61 Air National Guard pilot, where he had a dogfight with a light one night around Fargo in America. So this is, say, just like 2 weeks afterwards. And the crew of it was actually called an F-61 Black Widow, the change of designation in 1947, based in Japan. And it was involved in what they described as a series of cat and mouse interceptions of what they thought was an unidentified radar contact. Now, it wasn't just a radar contact, it was actually a visual contact as well, because the pilot saw something in the sky. So you're looking at one of, maybe not the first, but certainly one of the first radar visual cases in the kind of UFO legend. The Foo Fighter cases from the Second World War, were visual only, that they were never picked up on airborne radar or ground radar. But what was kind of strange about this particular case was whatever they were chasing, and whatever was sort of chasing them at one point, was its ability to either dawdle around, you know, very, very slowly at about 200 miles an hour. And it was always letting the aircraft catch up to it. And then it was rocketing off into the distance. And they estimated, based on the time it took to sort of disappear off the screen in the aircraft, at 1,200 miles an hour, which is really, really quick. And they wouldn't break that speed record until 1957. So, you know, you're looking at 1948 here, there were no aircraft in the world that could actually do that kind of speed. So that's quite notable. And although it's not quite the same, we're looking, you know, in terms of things that defy known technology, you're almost getting into tic-tac territory there. You're getting things that, you know, have abrupt change of the speed, can zoom off at speeds which are way in advance of anything that the current technology could have accomplished. And you're talking about a top speed of about 550, 600 miles an hour back then. It's not that quick, even for the late model jets back in the late 1940s, the kind of P-80 Shooting Star or the F-94 Starfighter. Anyway, so we're looking at two crew on board this F-61. There's a pilot who was called Oliver Hempel, and his radar operator, who was called Barton Halter. And in a statement that was made, it's actually made quite a lot later. So you're looking at 3 months later. So it took a long time for this information to come out for various reasons, which are unclear at this stage. He provided an account of what he's piloted and he had experienced that night. And if you don't mind, Vinny, I'll just read this out, if that's all right.
Go for it, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So he says that his present duties are radar and communications maintenance officer and the radar observer night fighter with the 68th Fighter Squadron, 347 Fighter Group. 15th October 1948, my pilot and I started out on a routine mission on the northwest coast of Kyushu, which is one of the islands in Japan. So it's the main island. And he says, when at 23:05 hours, we were at approximately 50 miles from, and he names a city which I can't pronounce, I picked up an airborne target. It showed up at a range of 5 miles dead ahead and slightly below us. So that's the radar operator saying that he's picked up something on his airborne radar. He then says, we increased our speed to approximately 220 miles an hour and obtained an advantage of 20 miles an hour. So they were gaining on this object at 20 miles an hour. The target showed no evasive action at first, and we thought it was probably one of the fighter aircraft from our home field. As we closed in, I noticed a slight change in azimuth and a rapid closure between us. So the object had changed the way it was going, and it was seemed to be heading either slowing down or it was heading for them. We dived in an attempt to follow the target, and before we could get squared away to follow it, it had passed beneath us and was gone. I notified by my pilot that we're diving at a rate of 3,500 feet a minute at 300 miles an hour, and it was gone. The next or second interception, so this is the second one, was rear from the rear of the target, again as the first. But then it put on a burst of speed and outdistanced us immediately. And then when they made another pickup, it was some in a different distance and a different altitude. So the pilot turned to try and head off the target to try and catch it up again. And again, there was a sudden burst of speed and it disappeared sort of 10 miles away. Now, that was the actual outer limit of the scope on the aircraft, which was 10 miles for airborne targets. And according to the radar observer, Halter, he said that it took 15 to 20 seconds. Now, if you estimate the time, the speed rather, based on the 10 miles and 15 to 20 seconds, you're looking in excess of 1,200 miles an hour. So that's how you work that out. And they said, in their opinion, they were showing a new type of aircraft that by some agency unknown to us. And then there's a huge amount of information from the intelligence people who looked at this as well. And the fact that the ground radars couldn't pick it up, but the pilot had seen this thing. And then, of course, it was picked up on radar as well. So it wasn't just it was a like a radar angel that the pilot had seen something, although he couldn't work out what it was. He could just see an object and it was slightly discernible. He couldn't estimate the size of it or whether it was jet or propeller driven. There was no trail, no exhaust flame, but it was obviously much, much faster and much more maneuverable than them. They had the pilot had a silhouette of the target, but he couldn't work out what it was because it didn't look like anything he'd seen before. And you couldn't really even describe it. And you've got a picture of it there, I believe. I sent you a picture of it, yes?
Yes, let me skip to that.
So that was what he said it looked like. And, you know, it defies description, really. It looks like an aerofoam. So you've got that kind of curved upper surface of like a wing, like a cross section and a flat underside. But in terms of an object, well, it doesn't resemble anything really. So, but that was what they were chasing and what outdistanced them very, very quickly.
So it's literally that oblong shape thing, wings, no control surfaces. The kind of, I mean, how dissimilar is that to a Tic Tac? I mean, it's not the shape of a Tic Tac, but it's not far off.
No, that's right.
So, and this is what, 48, did you say?
October 48.
That's incredible.
So you can see this in the Blue Book files. Mm. And you can actually read the interview that the radar observer gave to the investigators, and you can also read the intelligence summary, and what they thought as well. So it's all there. And if you read, and if you also read my book, you'll see it as well, because that's where most of that information comes from. So these are things that were seen really early. Now, of course, somebody might turn around and say, "Well, is this Chinese or Russian?" Because that's what they talk about nowadays. But you have to remember, back in 1948, the Chinese, sort of technology base was practically non-existent. They were in the middle of a civil war, or they'd just come out of a civil war, rather. And, they were essentially not much further along than the kind of warlord culture that they had back then. You know, their technology base for churning out aircraft and weapons, you know, they were reliant on other countries to supply them with things. And the Russians weren't in the stage then when they were actually giving the Chinese too much in terms of good stuff. But actually, the Russians didn't have anything like that could fly at that speed anyway. They were still in the first generation jet fighters. So you're looking at things like the Yak-15 and the MiG-9, which were really early types of jets. And they were all based, or the engines were based on German wartime technology. They were copies of German wartime turbojets. And then you had things like the MiG-15 were just coming along. They were just prototypes and they were just coming into the first flights. But you know, you wouldn't send them across somewhere like that. They were kept under lock and key in the middle of Russia. So in terms of what this thing was, you know, it's anybody's guess, really.
So out of all those countries and aircraft that you mentioned there, you'd say the top speed of all of them, or the most, would be sort of 600.
Well, yeah, you're looking at from the estimate. I mean, if the figures are accurate to what he said, so it's like 10 miles distance from where it was plotted to when it disappeared off the scope. And in the time it took, which was, he said, 15 to 20 seconds estimated, then you're looking at about 1,200 miles an hour or more. That's, let's say, twice the speed of anything that was in operational service at that particular time.
That's amazing. Yep. Listen, before we jump on to the next case, everybody in the live chat, I am seeing your questions, I think, but if you can put them in capital letters, I definitely, or more likely to see them. So far I've got Jeff, Jason and Vishwa. I've got your questions. In fact, before we jump on to the next case, let's jump into a couple of these. So Jeff says, Vinny, I have a question for Graham. Are there any modern day hotspots that seem to be associated with areas of sightings from the World War II time period?
Look at the 89 to 93 wave, the Belgian triangles. So that happened in a sort of part of, well, obviously it happened over kind of southern Belgium and, you know, that kind of area. And there were some cases from the Foo Fighter period of November to the end of the 44 to the end of the war that happened in that particular area with the 422nd Night Fighter Squadron. So yes, that's one I can think of. But then you look at some of the other places that were supposedly hotspots for wartime activities. They're not necessarily the same now. So you're looking at the Po Valley in northern Italy. That doesn't really feature much. I mean, I'm not actually up to speed too much on UFO cases in Italy at the present. So there may well be, but it's not, you know, something that tends to break into the, you know, more mainstream kind of like knowledge of modern day UFO encounters. So I could be wrong on that, but I don't think I am. And then the rest of them, well, there's no real hotspots beyond those areas. So, you know, I can't really sort of give you an answer for the rest of it.
Interesting. Thank you. Thanks for the question, Jeff. Let's jump into Jason's. Jason asks if there are any plans to narrate audiobook versions of your books.
Oh, that's plans.
We've had these conversations. We've had these chats privately.
I think it comes down to being able to do it and being able to actually sort of kind of the technology being there for me to be comfortable with doing it, and also getting people to help, because my voice isn't great to be able to, and nobody's going to understand me. If we get Andy doing it, then we're going to need subtitles. sorry, Andy. so, you know, it will, I'm sure it'll happen one day, Jason, but maybe not right at this moment. But yeah, it'd be a lovely thing to have. The Foo Fighter book, mind, it's 550 pages. That would take a very, very long time, and the chapters are quite long. Whereas the Dawn of the Flying Saucers is probably an ideal one to start, because the chapters are much shorter and they're more punchier. So, yeah.
How many chapters are there in the Foo Fighter book?
18 or 19.
So here's something that
Some are quite long, though.
That's all right.
You're talking about, like, you know, 70 or 80 pages, some of the chapters.
So here's a theory, you know, here's an idea. You get however many 18 separate members of the UFO community to do a chapter each. I mean, what do people think? I'd love to know what people think. Would you like listening to loads of people you know talking, or do you want one person doing the whole book?
And actually, if that was the case, who would you want to narrate them? Now, don't say Ross, because he would just do the voices for all of them, and he could do 18 different voices, and probably nobody would be the wiser.
Absolutely. But yeah, so hopefully in the future we'll get the audios. Vishwa's question, would something like Renderson Forest be MOD, US Pentagon, or both?
Well, there's a $64,000 question. It's like the Calvin. Sorry, we're going to go back this. We're going to, it's all right. Calvin, you know, the jury's out on that. A lot of people say, well, yes, it's some secret US technology. And I can be swayed that way. But equally, if you're looking at things that hover in midair and then zoom off into the, you know, into the stratosphere at a rate of knots, can we build that kind of technology? And if so, why isn't it, you know, in circulation 32 years later? And you could look at the same Relgium, which was even earlier. So why hasn't that technology appeared? So there's, you know, grounds to sort of suspect it might be, but equally there's things on the other side of the argument to say, well, no, because surely this would have happened by now. So I'm sorry, I can't say one way or another. We just don't have enough information at this stage to say yes or to say no. So more digging is needed.
But am I right in saying, well, I know for sure that Rendlesham features heavily in the documents from the National Archives and that.
Oh, it does.
I think there are some mentions in some of the, I don't know if it's the FBI files or the CIA files, but I'm pretty confident there is some documentation over in the US on Rendlesham as well, because it was a joint base.
That's right.
So yeah, there is information out there, but there's certainly no answers at the moment, unfortunately. But thanks for the question anyway, and yeah, let's should we move on to the next
yeah,
case?
Please. Yeah,
let's bring up this image and jump right in. There we go.
So we have a Martin Mariner flying boat, and this is US Navy. So this is Obviously, the major thing at the moment is to do with US Navy encounters off the West Coast and East Coast of America with the Tic Tacs and with cubes inside spheres and all the rest of it. Now, US Navy encounters with strange things go back to actually World War II, but this is a one from 1951. Now, this appears in Flying Saucer Fever. So we're looking at November 1951, and this is in the Yellow Sea. So again, we're off China, and this is a long-range flying boat on a maritime patrol, basically sort of flying along the maritime border with China, if you like, out to sea. But it's also in a position which is equidistant between China, North Korea, and somewhere in Japan as well. So it's a kind of flashpoint area, and of course, November 1951, slap bang in the middle of the Korean War. So naturally, aircraft based in Japan and also South Korea are going to be on patrol looking for targets of opportunity because the Chinese are already in the war by then. So we have this particular statement that was sent to the headquarters of Far Eastern Air Force, which was based in Japan. And this was forwarded to the Director of Intelligence of the US Air Force on the 12th of November 1951. And it reads this as such. There's only three paragraphs. A waist gunner on lookout duty at an open waist hatch sighted a light on the port side and notified the patrol plane commander. The PPC, patrol plane commander, saw the light and brought the contact to the attention of the crew, which verified its existence. The radar man confirmed the contact, reporting the distance as 12 miles. The light appeared to be a long, conically shaped flame, suggesting the exhaust of a reaction-type motor, such as a rocket or a ramjet. The size, shape, and color of the flame seemed to vary during the period of observation. Originally, the flame appeared to be short, with a red-orange hue. Later, the flame became longer, with a color changing to a white-orange hue, apparently after power was added. So, again, they picked it on a radar, but they also saw it. The patrol plane commander turned left towards the contact, attempting to silhouette the craft against the moon in order to photograph it. Evidently, the craft turned away, maintaining the distance of 12 miles, so a photograph was not obtained. Consequently, and then the name, the commander, increased the power setting to rated power in order to close the range. Radar contact was lost, but visual contact was maintained until the estimated range became 3 or 4 miles. Meanwhile, the crew was able to observe the body of the craft visually, while in addition, the commander was able to observe the wing shape, so that this thing actually does have wings, or at least seems to have wings, using binoculars. The hull was very large, estimated to be 60 feet long. The wings were swept back and down with a dihedral at the tips, bending at approximately 85% of the wing length. There was no empennage, which means a tail. That wasn't there. And the craft appeared to be flying at what they called a high angle of attack. So if you can imagine, that means that basically that it's nose up. So it's like that. It's flying along like this. Yeah.
Weird.
That's what that means. And you'll see in a minute when you pull up the diagrams, which I sent you as well. But there's only a few more lines here.
Sure.
And he says, the flight altitude, so this high angle attack, suggested a high speed plane staggering to keep airborne at a slow speed. So in other words, they thought it might be like a jet fighter, but having to slow down enough to keep up with or to keep station on the flying boat, because the flying boat was quite slow. Whereas a jet fighter, if it gets to a certain a very slow speed, it could stall and fall out of the air. Mm. And the best thing to do is you basically pitch the nose up, and that's how you keep sort of flying in an aircraft like that. At least that's what they suspected. And then the last bit is the craft accelerated slowly, increasing the range to 16 miles, as indicated by radar. It then accelerated rapidly to a range of 22 miles when contact was lost. Visual contact was then also lost due to the clouds along actually 16 minutes after the initial contact. They computed the speed of the aircraft as 530 knots for the period just before contact lost. So it's a lot slower than the one that was seen off Japan. But if you can possibly pull up the first of the images that I sent you. So in the Blue Book documentation, we've got a couple of plans of, and these are the sketches of what they said they saw. Now this one Yeah, okay, so you can see the general outline, and you can see these wings with the dihedral. So that's like the slightly downward facing pointing wings, sorry. And then these little kind of wingtips that pointed upwards. If you could just pop the next one up, please. And then this one here, and this shows you what the reckoned it might have been. So you can see the bottom right there, and that's pretty much from the previous drawing. And then they're trying to compare it to a MiG-15, which is a Soviet jet fighter. Now, in some respects, yes, it does look quite similar. And without the tail, it could be. And actually, in my book, I do have a picture of a MiG-15 from behind, which is shot by a US Air Force jet fighter gun camera as it was about to shoot one down. So you can see that, that's quite accurate. Did I send you a picture of a MiG-15? I think I did, so
I
the
think you
audience can
did,
see.
yeah.
Yeah, so somebody can see what it looks like if they're not familiar. There we go. So that's a Soviet picture of a MiG-15, and this is like a kind of second generation MiG jet fighter for the Russians. It was based on well, it was their own design. It was based on some German technology about swept wings, and if the Labour government hadn't supplied some jet engines to the Russians under some misguided agreement in whenever it was, 46 or 47, then they would never have the technology to build upon to build this aircraft, or so the story goes. Anyway, the Chinese got some of these about the time this happened. And of course, the Chinese were also supplying aircraft to the North Koreans. And also the Russians were supplying these aircraft to the North Koreans as well, and even supplying the pilots to fight against the Americans, which it wasn't something that was known until, maybe 20, 30 years ago kind of thing. So they were in the skies over Korea, but were they over the middle of the sea? Now, you had to do some kind of creative thinking to work this out. But if you worked out the kind of endurance of a MiG-15 and the speeds and all the rest of it wouldn't have had much flying time to be able to get out there from the nearest base in China or the nearest base in North Korea. It was just too far. Also, the size of the thing was twice the size of a MiG-15, and a MiG-15 was about 33 foot long. This thing was estimated at 60, so it was twice the size. And a MiG-15 stalled at about 120 knots. So yes, okay, if the pilot had been nose up, trying to keep out of the stall, it could have done it, but then it would have been using quite a lot of fuel up as well. A MiG-15 carried about 450 gallons of fuel, even with the external tanks, the drop tanks, if you like, burned it at about 5 gallons a minute. So that was about 45 minutes endurance. So that's how much time it had in the air from takeoff to landing, or falling out the sky, whichever came first. But this sighting lasted for 15 minutes. So you would have to, like, the pilot would have to take off from China, would have to fly across the ocean, meet up with this aircraft, and then they said it rocketed off into the distance. It disappeared off from visual and also from the radar quite quickly. So you'd have burned quite a lot of fuel off that way. So that's not fuel efficient. And then even by the time you got back to base, given the distance and the time, he'd have been on fumes, if not falling in the sea. So it wasn't something that was realistic back then anyway. And also, those early aircraft didn't have onboard radar, and the Chinese did not have radar to be able to guide planes back into landings. So it's some people have said in the past that this might have been a MiG-15, and clearly the intelligence people thought that might be what it was because they came up with that comparison. But when you drill down into the information and try and work out whether such a thing was feasible, it wasn't one of these. So the question is, what was it? And that's the $64,000 question again. It's something that just can't be reconciled with anything back then.
The funny thing that got me then is that you said that they had radar contact at about 12 nautical miles. Was that right? But then as
Yes.
they closed to three or four, they lost it.
That could be down to the vagaries of the kind of system involved, or
Okay.
it could be spoofing. It could be anything. It could be a range of things why they lost contact. But they did obviously re-establish it because as it went away, they still had it on radar until it finally broke contact. So there's various things happening here. But yes, as you say, visual contact was maintained 3 or 4 miles away, and radar contact was lost. but they were still able to actually see it visually. So was it whatever it was it jamming the aircraft? Was it, you know, spoofing the radar somehow? Or was it some other factor that meant that they'd lost it? Was it an intermittent glitch? You know, it's not clear on the records, I'm afraid. But, you know, that's, unfortunately, with the best will in the world, sometimes you're only kind of, you know, all you've got to go on is what they say at the time. And sometimes there are follow-up questions that the intelligence people, when they're, you know, interrogating the witnesses, or they come back to it later on. Sometimes there's follow-up questions that go back to the squadrons concerned. In this case, not.
Wow. It's a fascinating case. And that's the thing. There are just things that just, it's not prosaic, or the explanation's not prosaic, and you can't quite figure out what, well, so,
somebody, somebody in the chat here says they're imitating our tech. And I mean, yeah, as a possible scenario, that of course that's possible. We just don't know. But, you know, people talk about, you know, these missiles that have been seen in America that are flying near airliners. And some people are saying, well, they might just be imitating those. You know, they wouldn't be testing missiles in a place next to commercial airliner routes. So, you know, anything's really possible.
Amazing. We've got a few more questions here. Joss is the first one. So, Graham, there was a case between 68 and 70 above the Atlantic of a commercial plane followed by a big yellow orb. It even made Dutch TV, like Panorama here in Holland, but I can't find anything. Are you familiar with that one?
I'm not, I'm afraid, but it sounds intriguing.
So it does.
I've made a mental note of it. Thank you, Joss.
Yeah, you've got a little way to go before you hit the late 60s and early 70s.
Yeah, but that doesn't stop me looking at things.
True. Yeah. No, absolutely. So, yeah, Joss, if you come across anything about that, please send it to me. Yeah, you know where. I've got a question from Elena, but I might leave that one towards the end because okay. I think that's a really interesting one. So let me just check. Yeah, let's move on to the next case. And this is one that I requested you to discuss because this is something I've been looking into, but only kind of touched upon recently. So I've got quite a lot more to dig in on this. So shall I bring the gentleman on the screen, or do you want to start the story first?
Yeah, put the gentleman on the screen up. That's fine. Or put the aircraft up first, which I was... Yeah, no, that's fine. So the guy on the right is called... He's called Swiney. It's the way it's spelled. We're not very sure whether it's Swiney or Swiney because it's spelled with one N. It's presumed it's Swiney. So he's Flight Lieutenant MJE Swiney. And he's an instructor with the Central Flying School, which are based in England. At RAF Little Rissington, which is actually in Gloucestershire, so it's down the southwest of England. And really, the only kind of reference to this case is buried away in the National Archives in London. And you have to find it within what's called the operational record book. So that's a kind of like a diary, if you like. It's an official diary for the Central Flying School themselves. Most RAF squadrons, flights or operational training units, etc., actually have what they call an ORB, which is an operational record book. It's a day-to-day breakdown of missions, flights, and other information to do with the unit. And this particular reference comes up for the 21st of October 1952. And what it says is, Flight Lieutenant MJE Swiney, instructor, Lieutenant, because it's British, Lieutenant D. Crofts, RN, Royal Navy, student, sighted three mysterious saucer-shaped objects traveling at high speed at about 35,000 feet whilst on a high-level navigation exercise in a Meteor 7. Later, ATCC Gloucester reported radar plots to confirm this, but Air Ministry discounted any possibility of extraterrestrial objects. So that's in the ORB. So that's an official document. And that's actually an RAF document as well. So a lot of the time when you see RAF UFO reports, they don't appear in the ORBs. But in this particular case, it does. So it was quite noticeable. Just to go back to what the some of the terminology is. So we're looking at ATCC, which is Air Traffic, you know, the control center. So it was actually a ground radar or a series of ground radar sites that sort of picked this object or objects up as well. Now, as you say, that's have you found anywhere else, Vinny, that, you know, that this appears in?
Not yet, no.
Mm. Okay.
But I've had a few conversations, so I'm going to keep digging, see what I find.
You can find extra information regarding this case in a book by somebody called Peter Horsley. It's his autobiography. Now, he was a former wartime mosquito pilot, and he became extra equerry. It's kind of like an aide, if you like, to Her Royal Highness Prince Elizabeth, and then he also, and also to His Royal Highness the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Philip. And that was in 1953, became the Duke's full-time equerry. So he was quite close to the Duke of Edinburgh. And of course, Prince Philip actually had an interest in UFOs, as most people actually are aware of. And therefore, Peter Horsley had conversations with him on the subject of UFOs. Now, Horsley, in his book about his life, and not for Prince Philip's life, but about his own life, actually mentions this, and he talks about the Little Rissington incident, and this is a quote from the book. An instructor and his pupil instructor were carrying out a series of high-level sorties in a tandem seat Meteor, the pupil in the front seat, the instructor in the rear. The front pilot observed a circular flying object some distance away, dead ahead, filling about 3 inches of the swing screen, which was approximately 2 feet across. He had no previous knowledge of or interest in UFOs. The object was so strange that he immediately assumed that he had oxygen failure and informed his instructor, who took over control and turned the aircraft through 45 degrees. That would presumably be to see whether it's some kind of cockpit reflection, because that would be standard practice if you saw something that you weren't entirely sure. You moved the aircraft to a different plane, different heading, and then looked in the same position again just to see whether it was a reflection of a dial or something in the cockpit. He then saw the object, and the two pilots confirmed its description to each other, so they checked that they were seeing exactly the same thing. The instructor immediately reported the incident to Little Rissington Air Traffic Control, who were not aware of any traffic in the vicinity of the Meteor, and instructed him to approach closer. The crew turned again towards the object, opening up to full power. At Mach 0.8, so you're looking at about 500 miles an hour or so, they gained quite rapidly. But when the circular object filled half their windscreen, it certainly turned on it, suddenly turned on its side, like a plate, that was their words, and climbed away out of sight at great speed. It was not possible to estimate its size because they did not know its distance. Their description was similar to other reports, circular and emitting an iridescent light around its object, its edges, sorry. So Horsley only mentions one object in this book of his, but actually, according to the ORB records, there were three that the pilot and instructor saw. And at first, Michael Swiney actually thought that there might be parachutes coming down from some unseen aircraft above them, which might have been in trouble or might have been dropping something. Now, David Crofts, who was in the pupil in the front seat, he described them as being elliptical shaped and looking like circular pieces of glass reflecting in the sun. He subsequently learned that Fighter Command had scrambled jet fighters to intercept the objects, but of course that's never been confirmed by in the official records. It just merely mentions that they actually that they saw these circular objects. Now, I guess if you look at other fighter squadrons, you might actually find records of a scramble, but again, you might not, because things like that not necessarily recorded. Now, that could be a little job for somebody or myself to go through those records, and you would have to work out what fight squadrons were near enough to that part of Gloucestershire that they could have got a jet into the air and scrambled to try and intercept. And there would be bases around London and on the south coast of England, which would be well within range of there. So that was theoretically possible. But here's the other thing. Again, this is another radar visual case, because the Air Ministry investigators reckoned that they'd been in communication with every country in the world that was likely to have that kind of aircraft in the vicinity, and drew a blank. But the pilots were later told, and I'm not entirely sure who it's clear who told them, but the craft had been picked up by radar sites at a place called Box, and also a place called Sopley. Now, funny enough, Box later became known as RAF Rydlow Manor. And if anybody in the chat or listening to this, his ears are pricked up at that name, then, well, do you know, Vinny, what the significance of Rydlow Manor is?
I've heard it come up so many times. Is there a certain importance to it at that era, or do you mean in general?
No, much later. So it was the place where what they call the flying complaints flight was held, was based, but it was also an alleged center for investigating UFO reports in the UK under the under that auspices of the flying complaints flight. It's never really kind of been proved, but
that's the thing, it was always rumor, wasn't it?
Back in the 80s and early 90s, it was one of those places that featured in a lot of UFO books. So, you know, if you didn't get stories about Area 51 or things like that, then, you know, RAF Rudlow Manor would come up. And Tim Good used to write about it, and, you know, other people did as well. So,
were there some connections to aerospace companies as well to Rudlow Manor? Weren't there some base? I can't remember who they were. Maybe I'm just going off on a tangent. But
there were certainly stories about underground tunnels.
Yeah.
And all sorts of weird, wonderful things there. But again, it's these kind of stories that people come out with, and you have to take them with a little pinch of salt, sort of thing.
Absolutely, yeah. And shall I just jump on? Because I think
that's the last. Yeah, so that's the type of aircraft. That's a Meteor T-7, so it's a two-seat Meteor. This is the first type of jet fighter that saw service with the RAF, and this was the two-seat trainer version. And these aircraft were still, even though they were quite long in the tooth by the sort of the early to mid-50s, they were still in service. They were bringing out later versions of this, but this aircraft would have been in service with the Central Flying School. And this is not too dissimilar to the aircraft that the two were flying the day they saw the UFOs.
It's so amazing because that line where he says, you know, it appeared to fill half the windshield, turned on its side and then shot off at great speed. And I mean, that's mind-boggling stuff, isn't it? And I will just highlight here that you have actually written about it here on the UAP Media website, which this article is linked at the, below this video.
Yeah.
And I also want to highlight...
It's also pulled from the book as well. So that's based on pretty much what I wrote in the book a few bits like missed out. But
And then this comment here, our very own Dave Clark interviewed, says Spiny, but he means Swiney, before he died. That's from Giles. Good to see you, Giles. And I actually spoke with David a couple of days ago about the case, and he's going to send me the audio of that interview with Swiney in about a week's time because David's... on holiday at the moment, so I am going to be doing more digging. And the one thing that I like is listening to these interviews to hear the tone of voice when they're discussing them, because I did that with the Lake and Heath case, and there's just something about hearing it from the horse's mouth that it just is fascinating. So
I mean, if you look on YouTube, there are interviews, like news kind of broadcasts interviews with some British pilots from about that time as well, so, you know, in the mid early to mid 50s. So you get a kind of flavor about how they saw these kind of incidents and how they reacted. They're quite kind of stilted and stiff upper lip kind of broadcasts, as was the kind of thing from the time. But as you say, it's a really good insight into how they saw it and what they think about it. One of the cases is the airliner off Labrador that in 53, 54 time, that the crew saw these, you know, strange objects that actually changed shape. It was a main object with little ones next to it, but the main one changed shape three times. Now that's actually, you can see the newsreel news item that was done. They interviewed the pilot at Heathrow, you know, or London Airport rather, back then, you know, some days afterwards. And these are fascinating interviews, you know. So you can find things like that as well.
Absolutely. And what I saw a comment earlier saying, you know, it's kind of pointless discussing these kind of cases, or you're making mountains out of molehills, I think was the comment. The thing is, we're not trying to solve these cases. We're simply highlighting that these happened. They were reported. There are data points in there that make no sense, that were investigated, and they could not figure out what these things were. And I think comparing old cases like this and bringing it back into the modern times, comparing it, seeing similarities with modern cases, I think it's important to sort of put little pieces of the puzzle together. It may not lead anywhere, but it might. It doesn't hurt. So that's
I think when you look at it, you see today, you'll see a lot of explanations. Oh, they're Russian or Chinese. But you can't apply that kind of logic back then. So it's useful to know the history of the subject, because as you say, you can see parallels, but you can also see differences, and you can see a direction of travel. But also, they just build up a picture. And yes, as you say, we're never going to solve these cases, that because there's just not enough information. But they're unique. You know, they all have their own unique little piece to them, and they're fascinating. And if you just if you read enough of them, then it's an overwhelming kind of weight of evidence. And for people who are only coming into the subject quite recently, and for all you know, all they know are the Nimitz encounters and the 2015 sightings and the US Navy, the things that crowded the ships and all the rest of it, then there's actually this huge, rich back catalogue of things that happened that you know people are really unaware of. And yet some of them are absolutely fascinating. They're riveting stories. And some of them are actually quite unbelievable. If you look at the cover of Flying Saucer Fever, you'll see the B-36 aircraft, the huge the huge bomber that flew around, the Peacemaker. And the story of the UFO that if you see there actually sat between the tailplane and the rear-facing propellers. You know, sort of thing. So that's not something that you can just go, oh, yeah, there's no point in knowing about that. That's a kind of, well, where have you ever heard of a story like that before?
Yeah.
And the thing is about that case, I mean, I'll just quickly take a minute.
Sure, yeah.
About this.
Of course.
So this was the only part of the official file that the intelligence officer wrote about this case is the bit from the ground. And yet the intelligence officer himself, who saw it on the ground, wrote the file. And he says, out of the 70-odd pages in the file, there's not that many left. You know, so where are all these other pages, which presumably are from the crew? Because there'll be 15 crew members on that aircraft. You know, it wasn't a small aircraft. There were 15 crew on aboard. And those maybe half a dozen observation blisters, never mind the kind of cockpit and the other windows on the aircraft, where they could see this thing. And actually, you can almost make it out on that drawing by Dan and Olaf, that there were observation blisters right next to where that thing was sitting.
Yeah, here.
Yeah, and just above.
And there. Well.
Yeah.
My goodness. Wow. Imagine seeing that thing just like feet away from you. Yeah. That's incredible.
And they presumably would have had cameras on board the aircraft or a camera. So maybe there was pictures taken. We just don't know. Because that portion of the file, you know, isn't there. It's never been made public. Whether it's gone missing or something's happened to it, who knows? But the actual publicly available portion of the file is to do with the intelligence officer and somebody else who were standing on the ground at the airbase and they were looking up and they saw it and that thing was sitting in between the tail and the wings. And there was another one nearby.
That's unbelievable. Fascinating stuff. I've got a couple more questions here. First one is from my good friend, Mr. Ashley Cowie. Has Graham's research identified any particular type of World War II aircraft or radar system associated with UAP more than others?
Yeah, so the World War II kind of thing, well, you have to look at where they were. So there was basically two types of aircraft that the Americans were operating that were in close contact with the Foo Fighters, and that's the Bristol Beaufighter. So that was a British type that was supplied to the Americans because they didn't have a night fighter of their own when they were getting the squadrons together to do that role. And then the P-61 Black Widow, which you saw at the beginning of the program, the picture that Vinny showed. So those are the two aircraft that were in the European theater operations, at least, that were quite closely associated with Foo Fighters. But then there was all different types of aircraft from the RAF and from other air forces that were seeing things that they couldn't explain. So, you know, Lancaster bombers, Halifax bombers, Wellingtons, all this kind of thing. And probably some German aircraft, although as I've been at pains to point out over the years, you know, Luftwaffe records are quite non-existent. So we just don't know from that side.
Yeah, fascinating. So, and then I wanted to save this one because I think this is a great question. Hi, Faves. How did you get your start in the field of ufology, Graham?
Okay, I think I've told the story before, but probably some people probably haven't heard it. So when I was sort of 7 or 8 years old, I was quite interested in science fiction. I was reading Isaac Asimov books when I was 8 years old. And if anybody's ever seen the paperback versions of these books, they have some really, really good artwork on them, that, you know, sort of drawings of spaceships and all this kind of thing. And they were done by a certain number of artists back in the 70s, people like Chris Foss and some other people who people might know their artwork. It's certainly famous. Anyway, so I was quite into these books and I had quite a collection, you know, 20 or 30 of these titles. And my mother, bless her, she's long gone, but bless her, she bought me a book from a shop that she thought was another one in the series. And it had a nice picture of a spaceship on the front. But it turned out to be a book called Mysterious Visitors by Brinsley the Poet Trench, who actually was the Earl of Clancarty. And he was he was a government or a government minister or part of the House of Lords rather, and he was involved in the House of Lords debates in the 1970s about UFOs. And he'd written this book. He'd written other books in the 60s as well. And there, it was a mishmash of kind of biblical UFOs and things a bit more up to date from the sort of 40s and 50s and the contactee people, Adamski and all this kind of stuff. And then some more modern for that time events as well. So it, looking back on it, it's not the best of books. But for me, and being 8 or 9 year old, whatever it was catnip. It was fascinating, and I just went whoa. it did blow my mind, because previously I've been reading books about fiction characters. I'd watched the first the original version of Star Trek on BBC One in Britain in the mid 70s, and of course that was just like make believe. But here was somebody saying, well, actually no, some of this stuff's true. There are things from other worlds coming to visit us, and they're taking some of us away for whatever reason, all the rest of it, and experimenting and dropping them back in fields and all this kind of thing. And it was, I think there was some reference to the Men in Black as well and some other stuff. So it was all kind of just, and it just got me thinking. And of course, I wanted to read everything I could after that. So, I read all the books in the local library I could find. I was getting books given Christmas, birthdays, and all the rest of it, just went from there. So yeah, thanks, Mum.
I guess my follow-up is, when did you discover the UFO community?
Ah, right, okay. So that was much later. I knew one existed, and there was one existed back then, but obviously because that was well before social media, it was all done with, sort of personal contact at conventions, and there weren't that many in Britain, you would write letters to people, because that's when people put stamps on envelopes. There were some newsletters, a Flying Saucer Review in Britain, and those others in America, of course. So that was the way a community formed, whereas like a kind of online community, then that was kicking off in the late 90s. So I was part of an online community through what they called, there were chat groups back then. There were Usenet boards, Usenet groups, which was when you had a dial-up connection. It was really, I'm talking like mid-90s, late 90s here. And there was quite a healthy UFO community then. But you had your equal number of trolls and kind of kooks and just people who wanted just to, cause mayhem. And then a small core of people who generally wanted to pass information around or find things out and all the rest of it. So it's a kind of like a small microcosm of what's like now on UFO Twitter. there we go.
Awesome. That's fantastic. Well, I'm just going to bring up this image again for the book cover because... Yeah, there we go. I mean, guys, I've read the first one, the Foo Fighter book. I've still not got around to reading this one, but I can guarantee they're going to be incredible deep dives, and I highly recommend checking out Graham's work. Would you say, Graham, there is an order they should read them in? Does it matter if it's in chronological?
Strictly speaking, it doesn't matter. I mean, if you want just to pick one of them at random and start reading it, it doesn't, you're not going to lose anything by doing that. But if you want to do it in strict chronological order, then the Foo Fighters book comes first, and then you can see how the phenomenon develops, I guess. So you'll see the wartime stuff from say 40 right through to 45, and then if you buy if you get a hold of the Dawn of the Flying Saucers book, then you'll see the pre Kenneth Arnold stuff, because there is some things that happened before between the end of the war and Kenneth Arnold's sighting in June 1947. There's not many, but there are some. And then interwoven with the kind of 47, 48, 49 sightings, I've told the story of Project Sign and Project Grudge, which were the first two official US Air Force investigations into UFOs. So they kind of blend quite nicely. So you can see the kind of cases, or the aerial cases rather, because these are all pilot and aircrew cases. There's no kind of, for once on the ground, people seeing things on the ground. But you'll see how those sightings, sort of caused reactions within the intelligence committee and community in the US Air Force, and what they were trying to do to try to catch up, if you like, and try to find out what was going on. So it tells quite a nice story. In some detail, but I don't go, it's not a huge deep dive, but there's enough information there, hopefully, to satisfy people who want, a little bit more information. But for the people who are just coming to it quite casually, then it tells a decent story for them as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll bring that back up. So this one is 50-52. Yeah. Forward by Luis Elizondo, which is a really good forward. I have read that. And then if we just go back to this one. So this is 46-49, Dawn of the Flying Saucers, forward by George Knapp. There is a link below this video to Amazon where you can go and check them all out, order them. They are available on
Kindle.
Kindle, that's the word, they as are, well. Yes. So we've had forwards from Sean Cahill, Lou Elizondo, and George Knapp. So what can you tell us about the next book?
So the next one is going to be from 53-54. So again, it's a period of time when, you know, there were still quite a lot of things still happening. Some people seem to think that after the July weekends in 1952, when there was the Washington sightings over Washington, D.C., that things fell off a cliff. Well, they did in the public sphere, because the press basically went, oh, yeah, the American Air Force are telling us that nothing's happening. Oh, yeah. And they just went away. But actually, the phenomenon never went away. And reporting didn't really go away either, even the press or elsewhere. So, but there are quite a lot of interesting events in those 2 years as well. Now, rather than going and approaching some famous name, and I'm grateful to Sean and to Lewis and to George, this time for this book, I wanted something a bit closer to home in terms of the people that, you know, are friends and are people who are kind of fellow travelers in terms of looking at old documents, but also in understanding and appreciating the value of cases like this. So there are two people this time for forwards. And those of you who sort of see the kind of podcasts that we end up on may know who they are, but that's all I'm going to say.
Fair enough. Yeah. Let it be a surprise when it comes out. Yeah. Do we have a rough date when that might come out?
Well, the book's finished. It's been finished quite a long time, actually. I've just had it put away. And then because Dawn of the Flying Saucers only came out in June, I didn't want to rush another book out straight away. Yeah. So it may well be Christmas, kind of just before Christmas when it comes out. Nice. And then that's a nice marketing strategy, obviously. Full transparency. But nice. Yeah, no, it'll come out then. I'm waiting on one of the forwards. I've got one already. I'm waiting for the second one. And when I get that, then, you know, we'll see what happens then.
And will we be seeing another Dan Zetterstrom, Olaf Rockner collaboration?
Oh, I hope so. I wouldn't want to go to anybody else.
I just wouldn't look right.
It wouldn't sit right on the shelf.
No, not at all. Well, Greg, listen.
You would hate me.
Yeah, no, I'm sure if Dan or Olaf are watching this, I'm sure they've already bounced ideas off of each other, probably when they were in Sweden last weekend. I'm sure there were some good conversations. Well, Graham, listen, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. Fascinating cases. And like I said at the beginning, I'd love to do this on a, you know, maybe every 6 weeks on a rough thing like that, and just dig back into these cases that are heavily featured in the books. So yeah, that'd be amazing. So I just want to say thank you to everybody in the live chat for having a great cordial time, asking great questions. And I'm going to be back, where are we today? Sunday. I'm going to be back on Wednesday with Diana Pasulka. So I'm really looking forward to that one. If anybody has any questions for Diana, you can head over to my social media accounts and just hit me up there with some questions. But for now, guys, thank you again. Graham, thank you.
Thank you.
I'll see you on the flip side. Bye.